Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. This is where Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi bring you the latest news and information on pro wrestling and MMA, as well as interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap with your hosts, Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi.
Welcome to another edition of Ringside Wrap. Rich Tate, joined by Mike Sempervivi, and of course our guest this week, Les Thatcher. Les, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm the guest.
What's
all
that?
Right. All right. I got you.
Yeah.
Go
ahead. Go ahead.
I said here in Cincinnati, we went through the monsoon season, then we went through our high wind and tornado season, and now we're into the Sahara Desert season.
There you go.
Dry in the high 90s. We're having our July and August temperatures now, and if we have an inch of snow by August 30th, it wouldn't surprise me a bit.
You know, it's funny because you guys seem to always be about a week behind us here, only at least you get dumped on with the snow. If I'm sounding a little bummed tonight, well, it's just a normal show. But literally, seriously, the Thrashers spirit group let me down. So, Mike, who am I going to pull for in the next hockey season?
Well, of course, you're going to
have a team anymore.
You're a team with me and cheer up with the New York Rangers, or at least go Les's direction and go to Columbus. But, you know, I feel bad for you guys because obviously there's not a lot of hockey fans there, obviously. It's more of a college-driven town. With all of that said, it's too bad because this was chance two in the last 30-something years or, you know, now where they tried hockey in Atlanta. And sorry for you fans down there that do actually like it. You're probably never going to get the shot again.
Well, I'm going to disagree about having enough hockey fans to support it here. I've been reading that from a lot of people outside of Atlanta. For some reason, we obviously have a bad sports town rep out there. But, basically, number one, it is a college sports town because we didn't have any pro sports until, 1966. That stuff's, college football has been ingrained into the people here, whereas by the time we started having pro sports here,
good Lord, Richard, it's been a half century.
Yeah, well, but for the most part, everybody sucked for a half a century. it's hard for people to get passionate and continue to sink money into something that's, you know, when you've got four pro sports teams and two colleges close by that both have multiple sports programs. That's a lot of places to spend your money, and you're going to go where, well, let's face it, are you going to spend it on good product or bad product? So for the most part, you know, the Thrashers did as well as the Flames attendance-wise. The problem was ownership let this city down, and attendance did dwindle over the last couple of years, and, well, that's that. They're gone, and Winnipeg gets their next chance.
No matter how great of a media market Atlanta is, as many people are there and all that, it's got to just extra hurt a little bit that you're, even though it was Calgary the first time around, you're losing back to Winnipeg. Winnipeg! It's the only time somebody would choose Winnipeg over Atlanta. Only in the National Hockey League.
Les, you weren't here last week, and we talked a little bit about Randy Savage, but I just wanted to, before we get on to some new items, see if you had any comments you'd like to make at the top of the show.
Well, he was a great worker, obviously one of the most highly recognized performers of modern times. I bought tickets to see his dad when his dad first came out of the Navy and wrestled for Al Haff Promotions out of Columbus here back in the 50s. And then the first television match I ever had was in the Annapolis TV for Barnett Doyle in winter of 62, and that was against Angelo Poffo. I remember when Randy and Lanny came with their dad into Charlotte in the early 70s when they first started in the business. But, I never, was close with Randy or anything, but, you know, it's he was a young man. It's a shame that it happened. And like I say, you know, I think a tremendous performer. And, you know, I mean, I obviously is highly recognized by the general public for the Slim Jim commercial, probably as anything else. I mean, they knew he was a wrestler, but that commercial just, you know, gave him tremendous high profile across the country.
Les, obviously people are really shocked in hindsight where it's almost because he had a chance to go away and retire and really not come back or anything like that and saved his money that I think he kind of got out of people's minds. And I was really surprised with the outpouring from outside the wrestling world and the amount of people that crossed over that really it became such a big story. Were you surprised by that at all or still surprised in hindsight? Because I still have people that know, you know, really nothing about wrestling that are still, that know I like wrestling. They're still like, you know, I'm sorry to hear about Randy Savage. Like it affects me, you know, directly and personally on a certain level. I mean, it seems like everybody has said, you know, it's something about Randy Savage. Are you surprised in hindsight about that?
You know, I don't know, really surprised, Mike, but I guess sort of, yeah, I guess surprise is a good word. You know, I had people at the gym come up to me that have never, I mean, basically never, I mean, I guess they obviously knew, you know, my connection with wrestling, but it was not like it was something was never a discussion, you know, but then they come up and say, did you know the guy that just passed away, Macho Man? You know, and some of them weren't necessarily aware of, you know, I don't even know if they're sure his name was Randy Savage. You know, they just knew Macho. And it was, you know, the Cincinnati paper picked it up. You know, it was, yeah, I think the coverage was, well, yeah, and probably, you know, yeah, it surprised more because he hadn't been in the public eye. You know, he had, you know, been retired and hadn't been doing, you know, Legends conventions or, you know, anybody's TV since he popped up briefly on TNA in its early inception. So, yeah, but, you know, I think, you know, overall, he, you know, was deserving, you know, because, again, one of the, you know, an over-the-top personality, you know, and a hell of an athlete.
I don't want to beat anything into the ground, but actually I haven't really heard it talked about that much. I didn't hear your show this past week on the Observer site, but I did hear 2 weeks ago, and it really didn't come up, so I'll throw it out there at you. There's very few people that can actually talk about anything about the ICW in Kentucky, or if they do, it doesn't really get brought up, and I think it's been one of those things that in a way has kind of been forgotten the history. Now I think people are just, now they actually know those stories and know how bitter the situation was down there. On a past show here, you did talk a little bit about how ugly that was and how you thought they went in and basically really crapped all over an area and really, really hurt it. You being there at the time, can you talk a little bit about just how nasty that ICW feud was and why?
You bought
a ticket to see Angelo, and then he, you know, he turns around later on, and there's this situation in Kentucky. I mean, just what was all that kind of like?
Well, you know, with us, it was supposed to be a big surprise that Roop and Orton and Garvin and Wright, you know, were pulling out. But honestly, we were forewarned, and you know, that. Now, you know, nothing happened. I know there's more over on, you know, the Jared end, you know, with guns being pulled and that sort of thing. You know, a lot of stupid challenges on our end. A lot of silly skits on their television, you know, making, you know, light of guys, you know, in our promotion. And honestly, all it did, and I've said this anytime this has ever come up, all it ever did in the Knoxville territory is kill a damn good territory. I mean, nobody won the war. It split the fans there, you know, a lot out of curiosity. And, but it, you know, it never, well, you know, it one night in a bar, it kind of got physical. It didn't last very long. But like I say, and when the challenges were thrown out, it wasn't like, this is an open challenge to anybody, because it wasn't. You know, it was specific, and it was, you know, they were picked. I mean, nobody challenged Tony Charles. Nobody challenged Dick Slater.
I was going to say, the hell of a thing for, you know, a Bob Roop to challenge Bill Dundee or somebody along those lines.
To challenge who?
Also, you know, a Bob Roop challenging a Bill Dundee where you go, oh, you know,
you got a type of wrestler. Well, you know, Roop and Slater, you know, they started the war of words, and as close as I got to it, actually trying to defuse it, because we were in a club that the wrestlers had frequented since Fuller had bought the territory in 74, and yet, you know, they start, you know, but it didn't last. And I wouldn't say there was a winner or a loser in the thing. It was just broken up and it was done. But, you know, again, it did nothing but kill the business there for everybody. And it never, you know, the business never came back then until Smokey came in, you know, but it had to be let die. I mean, and when I say this, realize that at that time, that territory was red hot. It was making money for everybody. That was the crazy part. And I think, and here again, I won't mention names because I can't speak for that whole crew that jumped ship and went with Angelo. But I know for a fact, I know at least one or two have said out loud, it was a mistake. You know, I was made the offer to make the jump and wouldn't, simply because I helped build that territory. That territory is a big part of my life even before Fuller bought it. But I built that TV from the ground up and from scratch. And we had one of the best television. Well, in fact, some of the stuff we did there is commonplace in wrestling now. And it wasn't at the time. And I've said that too, regardless of who says what about what, if you get a chance to ever compare the two televisions, we smoked their butts every week. I mean, in terms of production and TV quality and stuff. The business just, you know, started to fizzle out for everybody because even, you know, the economy, it wasn't an economy problem back then, but still, you know, the fans only had so many, you know, entertainment dollars to spend. And for a while, they'd bounce back and forth, and then they, you know, took their allegiance, and then it just, you know, it was just too much for everybody. So it died out. The last time I heard anything about a challenge, and again, I won't embarrass anybody because it would be embarrassing if I were to mention names here, except that when Flair and Crockett and Mulligan bought the territory, a gentleman who worked security for us and by the name of Ed Hammond, and Ed's passed away, owned a car wash there, came into the dressing room. I was sitting here firsthand, was privy to this the night this happened, but Ed came into the dressing room and said to Blackjack, he said, so-and-so and so-and-so came into the car wash this week, and they said, well, now that we've got new owners, I guess we need to start issuing new challenges. And Mully said, Ed, you can go back and tell so-and-so and so-and-so they don't need to waste their valuable television time. Just tell me where to be and what time. And that was the end of the challenges.
In a really backwards way, and obviously you did feel kind of that late 60s and the early 70s and you know, what was celebrated at the Night of Champions in Smokey, in a backwards way, did the burning out of that territory because of all that kind of, in a way, seal the history and the legacy of those people that can remember back that far, and just in the fact that they didn't end up moving on in a lot of ways? I mean, did that kind of seal, in a really weird way, the history of the promotion?
Yeah, I suppose it did, to a certain degree. You know, it was, like I say, we went in there with fresh ideas, right? To backtrack a little bit, we started there in November of 1974. Ron bought John Kazan out. John ran Knoxville. When I first went to Knoxville in 1968, when I first went into the Nashville territory, there was no television. John got television in 69. Whitey Caldwell and I were the first two baby faces hot on that TV. Ron and Don Wright were the first two heels. We drew big money there. In fact, I would say probably still up till the day, we hold, actually in terms of people, bought asses and seats, we still hold the record at outdoor amphitheater at Chilhowee Park, which is where they have their fair and which is where, both promotions ran there. Now, Fuller Southeastern, dollar-wise, drew more money because the ticket prices were higher later on. But they never beat our record in terms of people. But anyway, then John ran Morristown and Newport. Occasionally. It was not it wasn't like every week. There were times you'd go in on Friday, work, stay over, catch TV Saturday morning, and then work Morristown that night or Saturday night or Newport. Ron is the one expanded into a territory. And, we went up into Kentucky, Williamsburg, Barberville, Harlan, Hazard, Whitesburg, places like that, and all over East Tennessee. And it was you were home every night. I mean, you got to stop and think. And there was a waiting list to get into the territory and top guys, because you were home every night. The longest trip was Harlan there were a couple of shots made occasionally were spot shows, but on a regular basis, Harlan was a long trip at 125 miles. And, you were home every night. Everybody was making money. And the big rap was, and you can read this on some of the historical websites. And I'm not telling tales here the big deal is part of the reason they jumped was in part because, a lot of the guys, Robert Fuller was the little brother who was a pain in the ass. But he was a pain in the ass for those of us who stayed too. I mean, he had been taken care of. Ron worked his butt off and Robert played. And a lot of guys didn't like that. But, in fact, I had, it had come to where I'd said to Ronald at some point, his brother just, needed to pick up the pace. And then there was, Ron was taking money off the top. Well, if you were a promoter in the mid-70s, hold your hand up if you weren't taking money off the top would be my guess.
Is only Paul Bosch's arm up in the air right now?
There's a lot of dirt between Paul and that surface.
That's true.
Paul Bosch was, there was a lot of honorable men, Mike, but if you got first count on the tickets, then the box office is what you make it.
True.
And if you weren't there, your opinion is about as valid as mine would be on the if the world's going to end tomorrow. Everybody, when you've climbed in the ring and you can take a fair count on a house and then you see the payoff, somebody's screwing with the books. And
I don't want to take you out of that, but I do want to ask you, did everyone just assume they were getting screwed but were happy with the guys who were the most fair with the payoffs, or was it, is that basically how it went? Like, well, we know we're getting screwed, but at least this guy's going to pay me the most out of it.
Well, I don't know if you were getting screwed every night, but I mean, I've worked for reputable promoters where I would guesstimate that the count wasn't accurate totally. But then again, that was just part of the business. It was, it wasn't like anyone held a gun to your head and said, you have to be a professional wrestler. I think we all knew that. And the guys who took the jump were making more money before they jumped. That's the problem. I mean, it wasn't like they went someplace else. I think part of the deal, it was a profit sharing thing on the other side, but then you can only share what there is to share. And part of the reason that they were so successful in fragmenting the fans in the territory was that we had built them as stars. And I say we, and I'll take, Garvin came in red hot as a heel, and then just like most anybody in the 60s or 70s, you know, at some point, if you take your hottest heel and switch your babyface, he's going to be a red-hot babyface. And all those guys had been pushed, you know, as top guys. So when they, you know, but we still had top guys, too, with Slater and, you know, Tony Charles and, you know, and guys, and Ron and Robert were over, as far as that's concerned. You know, again, Ron wasn't doing anything that a promoter in any other territory that still worked wasn't doing by, you know, keeping himself good because he knew he wasn't going to leave the territory. He wasn't going to argue over a payoff. Like I say, what, you know, I never had my hands in the till. I never handled the box office. I couldn't tell you yes or no that he took 50 cents or $50 or $50 million. But if you could prove that he did, I wouldn't be shocked or have a heart attack because of it, because I doubt seriously that I ever worked a promotion or a territory where there, you know, somebody didn't take some off the top. I will say this, because it was my suggestion, and I know that it happened. I know that at least for the first couple of years, I can't say past that, but I know for a fact the first couple of years, because we were trying to do something fresh, something a little different. And I said, you know, promoters say, hey, you know, Merry Christmas, take time off, go home, see your family. But there's never anything there. I said, it'd be nice if the guys, you know, if there was some, you know, something from the promotion. So I know for the first couple of years that whatever, I don't know exactly the dollar amount or the percentage that was taken, and at, you know, then at the holiday time, at Christmas time, that each one of the guys, I don't know what the bonus was, you know, $50 or $75 or $100 or whatever, realized it's the mid-70s, so it wasn't $1 million or $1,000, you know, got something at Christmas time. We, you know, it was a great territory. The crew, you know, the guys socialized together. Everybody worked together, and this came to, you know, and the thing was, Roop, we, Ronald and I, because I had my fingers in running the thing, we had socialized and worked with Bob in Tampa in 1970, or 71, excuse me, and then I'd worked with, you know, I was in the Carolinas, he was there in the later on. And in fact, when he was doing the challenges there, I was part of that, you know, going around and seeing that that was handled properly and you know, for the Crockett office. So then he came out of Frisco. We were looking for a booker. When Ron first opened the doors, I built the television. When I say I built it, I hand drew the first format for the first TV because Anna never had a format. There was never a format for that television. And he gave me carte blanche to do what I wanted to the TV.
Now, so have you ever done anything? How much have you done ever firsthand, hands-on in doing that?
How much what?
How much did you ever do hands-on, like firsthand, as far as being? Did he just kind of throw it to you and say, "Do your best," or did you sell him on the idea that
yes,
no, I can do
yes.
it?
Yes, I. Well, we had talked. We became friends in Tampa. His youngest son is my godson. Cole. And so when he came, you know, when I started there, it was, you know, television is your bag and it's not mine. We had talked about different things and I'd run ideas by him, fresh things, new, well, personality profile. Nobody ever done anything like that, ever. And a lot of the old timers said, you can't do that. You can't do a low key thing, sit down, interview in the middle of a show. It'll kill your heat. Well, obviously it didn't. And a lot of people started using it after they saw what we were doing with it. But the first weekend I flew in, I was living in Charlotte from November 74 to November 77. I communicated every weekend. I'd fly out of Charlotte or sometimes drive, but fly out on Friday morning. He'd pick me up at the airport and then work the show Friday night. We'd lay out the TV, work on the TV Friday afternoon, work the show at Knoxville on Friday night, produce television Saturday morning, work a spot Saturday night, and I'd fly home back to Charlotte on Sunday. I was doing Charlotte TV on Wednesday. I'd go in Monday morning with George Scott, start working on TV there, blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, I'd pass myself in the air sometimes, but that first week, November 74, he picked me up at the airport that first weekend in, and we went to his house, and he said, well, we got to put a TV together. We were still at the ABC affiliate at that time. We moved to CBS Channel 10 in 75 is where we really got red hot. Kazana started with, I think it was 26 at the time. It's been too many years ago. But anyway, it was the ABC affiliate. It was a UHF station at the time. And he said, okay, we got to lay out the TV. I said, okay, well, let me see your formats. We don't have any formats. I said, excuse me, we don't have any formats. Kazana, I was a star on Kazana's TV, but other than to be interviewed or know what the finish was or what angle we were working, I mean, at that time, I wasn't involved. I didn't get involved in doing television until 1970 up in the Maritimes with Rudy Kay. So, I wasn't privy to all that. So anyway, I said, okay, give me a ruler and a pencil and some 8.5 by 11 plain paper, and I drew a format, and we went out and had some Xerox copies made and came back. And when I took a format to the director at Channel 26 on Saturday morning, he looked at me like I was nuts. He'd never seen a format. I mean, he's seen run sheets and stuff for all their programming probably, but never for wrestling, not when John had it. And so it was a whole new thing for them. But, I designed the openings for the personality profile for the show. The concepts were basically mine. I mean, you know, and at the beginning, Nelson Royal and I were the tag team champions. And when we were helping Ron do the booking, and then Jody Hamilton came in and helped with the booking. And then after that's when Robert came in. And, of course, Robert got a lot of the credit, but I think the groundwork had been pretty well laid out. And then I think Robert's track record afterward would kind of stand the proof that he wasn't a genius in Knoxville, because he never had that kind of success anywhere else with a book. But anyway, that was the deal. And we built the television and built these guys on the television. So when they made the jump, you know, it wasn't hard to take, you know, a fair, if you were a Ronnie Garvin fan and you found out Ronnie Garvin was back over on Channel 26, well, then you turned on Channel 26, and some of these people bounced back and forth, you know. But it just fragmented the thing and ended up killing the friggin' business for everybody. So, there was never any guns, and, you know, there were challenges thrown out, but nobody ever answered them. And like I say, the one that I mentioned, Bulligan, said, well, just tell me where to show up and what time. Nobody ever bothered to tell Blackjack that. Probably smartly so.
My last question about this time, Duke, and we're probably going to be pulling his hair out. I don't want to take you too much down memory lane this early, but when the move came and they decided to sell to Crockett and Blackjack and Flair and go worry about the golf, did anything change in the TV aspect or anything like that? Or did you end up trying something else? Because I haven't seen a lot. I've seen very little as far as extended clips from that era from Knoxville TV when Crockett had it. Did anything at all change with the TV, or did you do anything as far as them coming in and buying it where it's just like, okay, let's try this, see what happens? Hello? Is anybody there?
Les?
Oh.
Les is showing online. Okay, Les apparently dropped off.
You and I are here.
Yeah, yeah. Ask the question again. I'll make up an answer.
Okay. Hey, did anything change in the actual TV when you guys took it over? Or when he sold a Crockett. Can you come up with a good one for that?
I plead the fifth. I'm not sure what happened to Les. He's still showing on the line, still showing active. So, don't know. Maybe he didn't like the way this was going. Who knows?
Well, I can say this. When it comes to Les Thatcher, that was not a cell phone dropping out.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a cell phone. So, let's see what we can do about getting him back. And in the meantime, you did see UFC 130 over the weekend. I know you. We want to get that out of the way, so let's go ahead and throw that out there.
Yeah, well, you know, not the their most exciting show. This was the show that was supposed to have, we talked about it a little bit last week, Ray Maynard and Frankie Edgar in their third fight, coming off the draw that they just had for the 155-pound lightweight championship. And realistically, even with this on this past show, it would not have helped pay-per-view buys. It probably wouldn't have helped the show all around. Also, it would have been a good fight, but unfortunately, this one, you know, Rampage Jackson, who they really need to hype up this fight with Matt Hamill, didn't do it. Frank Mir and Roy Nelson, who they really need to hype up their heavyweight matchup, realistically didn't do it. So it was kind of flat going in, which is too bad because it wasn't a bad show from top to bottom. It wasn't offensive at all. It was a good show, but you go, was it a $55 show? You know, it's arguable if it was by, you know, some of the standards that they've set for themselves. But, again, Woman Down in History is an awful show, but they didn't do enough, I don't think, from the fighters' end. UFC kind of, in a way, did all that they could outside of not making Mir and Nelson the main event. I think they should have did that. But, frankly, it wouldn't matter because if they weren't out there selling the fight hard and they didn't do that, neither did Rampage, unfortunately. It wouldn't have mattered whatsoever.
Well, Avir, and we've got Les back on the line now to finish the UFC discussion.
I don't know what happened. I could hear both of you guys, and I don't know why you couldn't hear me.
really odd. You were showing online. Mike, in regards to UFC, I mean, obviously a very busy month going on the last on Memorial Day weekend, and then, of course, Ultimate Fighter finale coming up this weekend, UFC 131 the week after that, then, of course, Strikeforce on the 18th and again on the 24th, and then another UFC Versus event on the 26th, and then, of course, July the 4th weekend, UFC 132. That's a lot of MMA here over the next, 5 weeks?
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they hear Dana White say he wants to have a show every single day, everywhere in the world that carries the UFC name, and it makes sense. I mean, from a sporting aspect, obviously the World Boxing Council and organizations like that, you know, it's like the NWA. I mean, you know, they wanted somebody, you know, to use their name and to kick back to some money to them, and they wanted to have, you know, the NWA name known worldwide, no matter where you go, there was NWA wrestling, and the UFC wants to do the same thing. They want to be a global brand. They want to make sure that the UFC and mixed martial arts in America, it's basically synonymous. They want that same thing around the world. They want to be able to do that. The bad part is, obviously, there's going to be burnout as far as a lot of fans go. Now, I think he needs to continue to do it because it's not like it's accepted in every state in the world and every country in the world. I mean, they are still not in lots of places. I mean, we talk about New York and Sydney and Toronto here, which they obviously just got into, but they've had issues in Germany. There's places that just don't, the UFC is not in or are not, they're not pro MMA, and they need to continue to build, and the want to have that spread all over the place is very important. The thing is, now it's going to be a case of people are going to have to start covering, you know, specific things and certain things. You know, everywhere soccer is played in the world every day, every minute of the day. But, you know, there's people that do the British Premier League. There's people that just, you know, worry about the MLS. And that's going to have to be the situation for fans now and everything where they get upset that, oh, God, they're having shows all the time. Well, you can't watch every single fight that ever took place. And, you know, we're going to start seeing a big change in media and how it's covered, I think, by people and how people watch mixed martial arts, because until it's everywhere, they need to continue their efforts to put it everywhere. But as people that consume it, they're not going to be able to see everything. And sometimes over and out analyzing things like, why didn't this draw? You know, 300,000 pay-per-view buys is still a lot of money. No matter how you cut it, it's a lot of money, and nobody else is doing it. So to call a show a failure because of that anymore, I don't think is necessarily, you know, the fairest thing you can do. Although, you know, selling a lot of pay-per-views, no matter how you cut it, is always a good thing. And again, it's going to be a very interesting time. It's a very interesting time for people who like sport and who like business and things like that. The UFC it's an interesting thing to continue on to watch and to try to follow.
All right, and I'll let you throw it back to the old school again, because I know you'd asked a question, and that was where we eventually lost Les. So, Les, if you want to pick up where you thought we were hearing you, go ahead.
Okay, we're talking about the TV when Crockett bought the thing, and I said, let me back up. When Barnett bought it, the idea was jump talent between Atlanta and Knoxville, which in theory and logistics actually made a lot of sense, and it happened to a certain degree, but it never again, the damage had been done. I stayed on. Ron, Fuller bought Fields out in Mobile. The whole idea there was to run two southeastern territories, and that's the way it started. Mobile was the south end, and Knoxville was the north end. In fact, I did TVs for both. We did an all-tape show that was sent down there to use in Mobile to start the ball rolling, and the idea was to swap talent back and forth. But then once the war broke out in Knoxville, Ron lost his taste for it and sold it and moved to Mobile. So anyway, I stayed on Barnett. In fact, I know, Thatcher's, that's where the name came from Jim Barnett. My last name, Thatcher, was given to me by Jim in 62. I always considered that TV my little bastard child because I, had raised it from infancy. And one of Jim's people came in to help there. And like a lot of people and a lot of corporations with a lot of, some people think they have to make changes just to make them so they can prove to somebody that they're worthy of who they are. And I kind of bowed my back at making changes. And this person went to Jim and said, well, he thinks it's his TV, which in reality, like I said, I always looked at it as my bastard child, but I knew who I signed my paycheck. So anyway, we agreed to disagree. Barnett and I had disagreements, but we never had a problem. And so anyway, I finished up on the TV, and then I went down to Mobile to work with Charlie Platt on the Dothan show and help handle, some of the towns for Ron out of the territory down there, and I lived in Pensacola. So anyway, when Crockett and Mulligan and Flair bought the thing, Flair called me and said Channel 10 had said they would be very much more comfortable with doing television with us if you were to come back and handle it, because I was a go-between. I was the guy going to the TV station. If they had a problem with the show, I was one of his deal with it and go back to Ron and or whoever was the booker at the time and say, okay, we need to stop doing this or start doing this or whatever. So I had a good working relationship with Channel 10. So they made me an offer, which was better than what I was making at Mobile. And so I went back to Knoxville. And actually the change, we went more back to doing the TV, basically, it never made a huge change. We were more back to doing the way we started doing it there in 75, 76, in terms of format and everything. It's just that there again, see, we were supposed to, with a Crockett buy-in, Roanoke, and a lot of those towns were supposed to end up being run out of the Knoxville end. And even with Flair as a partner, I don't know, we used Rick one time in there. Stud came in. Terry, that's where Terry Taylor got his start. King Kong Bundy, Chris came in there, probably 100 pounds lighter than he was when he was King Kong Bundy and was just getting his start. But we had some good guys. Kevin Sullivan and I were basically handling television and booking. He'd come over to my apartment and do the booking around my dining room table, and then we'd lay the TV out according to that. But, it just, it never caught fire again. That was, and I don't think, regardless of, now maybe, if Crockett's, we'd have brought a lot of that talent in and just saturated it. If they'd have been willing to take a loss for a while, then that might, it might have caught hold again. But, from the time, the split, it started, peter out, and it just never caught hold again. And then finally, no big promotion, there's a lot of little, splinter groups that ran around there, but nobody did any serious drawing there until Cornette went in with Smoky Mountain.
God, we could talk about this stuff all night, and I don't know if you guys want to or not. If we want to take it back into today's times, We don't have to talk about TNA tonight if you guys don't want to. I don't want
God,
to.
God, no. No.
Okay, good.
No.
What is there to talk about? I mean, you know, the sad thing about that, you know, it's been, you know, we could have a recording. They have some good talent. They have no clue what the hell to do with it. It's been diminished just simply by being used over and over. There is, you know, different characterizations.
But,
I think
come
TNA
on,
is right where
Come on, Les. Wrestling matters now.
I know. That's why we talk more.
And yet nothing
ties women. Yeah.
And
okay,
and
check in the mail, and I'll respect you in the morning.
Yeah.
Is it, any conversation about TNA can also end with just a repeating 1.1.
There you go.
The 1.19, so...
Well,
yeah,
you know,
that's it,
Mike. That's where they're. I think that's where they're going to be. I don't care what they do at this point. I don't think it matters. They've kind of been like the little boy that cried wolf. I mean, they've yelled change, but nothing. I mean, you know, you can change your set, you can change your colors, you can change your name, but if everything else, you know, it's not compelling television. It's just not. They have their core audience, and I think that's where they're going to be. I don't see that changing at all.
It was so embarrassing. To me, it's again, I can't get mad at it anymore because it's not my money being put into it or anything like that. It just really, you know, disappoints me as a wrestling fan. But it was embarrassing for me to watch them do the same thing with the X Division. This time it was Abyss, and I know they have a little bit of a different mentality of how they went about it. But, you know, Pierre-Carl Ouellette went down there, and they already did this thing where the biggest guy, you know, and Samoa Joe is a different story, but, you know, this huge guy is wearing the X Division title, and, you know, they did such a poor job with that with a guy like Frankie Kazarian, who is one of their brighter spots, at least with something to kind of go on, and they have him slip on a banana peel and lose, and it's just like, geez, it's cringeworthy, and it's, you know, and it upsets you as a wrestling fan, but it's so embarrassing to watch it where they're copying their own things for the fifth time that haven't worked. And again, I don't know what it is with Panda. I don't know what it is with the relationship with Vince Russo, but, you know, it's amazing how the one thing that's never changed there, you know, from the ownership to everything about it, the one thing that's never changed has been Vince Russo, and it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to see people hate money this much.
Well, you know, I think here's the, you know, and everybody seems so concerned with the X Division, and I, you know, I won't undercut those kids. They're good athletes, but it's like that first week that Brian Kendrick came out leading the eighth grade gym class.
That's it. Yes.
See, and that's it. You just got the answer to it with my little sarcastic inflection. You can't make a guy look like be a badass heel when he looks like your 12-year-old grandson. I'm sorry,
Billy
you Kidman. Can't. They're good athletes. They're good actor. I mean, they're good athletes. They're good acrobats. You know what? I'm going to say this for the 10,000th time, and I'll say it for 10,000 more if you ask me to. You're never going to see those guys draw big money on top at a pay-per-view, period. End of story in anybody's company. Your boy Sin Cara, they've got to get him some of his boys to come in so he can flippity-flop with somebody that understands what the hell he's doing. And he's not going to draw in this country unless it's in Chicago or L.A. or somewhere with a big Latin American influence.
And that would be okay. Les, I think that would be okay. I think, and it's, I don't want to like sound like I'm overly defending Sin Cara because obviously Mystico has botched the spots and everything, but they botched the whole thing. They still haven't explained, and here's where I know you're going to jump through the phone at me. The lights would be okay. They need to lighten them up, but the lights would be okay if they came out with somebody before he even started and said, some men do this for championships. Some men do this for money. Some men do it because they can beat somebody up legally and get paid for it. And some people put on the show to fight the good fight and try to do something that way where they still have never explained the lights, which it's just like they have done. I don't want to say they've done everything wrong because the packages leading into this have been fantastic, but it's one of those things when it comes to WWE, like with their developmental system and a lot of other things where it's like, you know, they do so many things right, yet stuff like this, it just boggles my mind that it could be done all wrong.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Ray got over because Ray is a San Diegoan, right? I mean, I don't give a damn what his name or his nationality is. He learned to work here.
Yeah.
Right? He can make the transition. All the Spanish-American guys, all the Mexican guys that I worked with over the years, I don't know what they did south of the border. I wasn't down there. But up here, they worked like the rest of us. That's what's going to get over here. That's, you know, now they can bring his mother and his brother and his sister and his aunt in to work, to put him over. But the bottom line is it going to correlate into people wanting to buy pay-per-views to see it if they don't understand it? It's, you know, I don't care if, you know, if you're a Mexican-American under a mask or you're of Italian descent or Irish, that style, is not going to equate into being the top draw on a pay-per-view. It's entertaining. It's mid-card. Now, you can say I'm saying that because I'm old school, because I believe in Lou Thesz. You can find any excuse for that, but there is no excuse. That's just the facts of life. You know, it's the same reason that base stealers don't draw money in baseball, home run hitters do.
That's true. And, you know, and they started it well with, he went out and he surprised Sheamus, and I forget who the other bigger guy was, Jack Swagger, that he jumped on. And it's just another example, too, where two things that drive me nuts out of this is, again, it shows, you know, George St. Pierre, 170 pounds, can choke you out and kill you. You know, if you had guys that, you know, positioned that way and that do things like that, you know, obviously there's always going to be that divide between junior heavyweights, light heavyweights, cruiserweights, and heavyweights, and that's fine. I'm okay with that, as long as you treat those guys with respect and at least have them, you know, at least stepping into reality when it comes to, you know, sometimes a smaller guy can beat a bigger guy. You know, obviously, when things are messed up.
Realize that the bet, I mean, the cruiserweights in WCW, back during the Monday Night Wars, I watched WCW never to see the main events. It was to see Malenko and Guerrero and Benoit,
yeah,
and Jericho, because they could mix some of the spots in with wrestling. They did the same stuff that the guys 250 pounds did, which is what sells in this country. And if you can mix the two, then you've got a winner, I think. But still, for whatever reason, it's, you know, is Taker a high? I mean, yeah, okay, he dives over the top rope once in a while, but I mean, he and Helmsley aren't high flyers, but that's the show. Christian and Orton, that pay-per-view was a one act show, and I knew that beforehand. And I'm going to say now, let's jump to this past Monday night. Your boys and mine, the Dave and Brian show, both thought that Kofi and Ziggler had a good match, and I totally disagree, and I sent him an email to tell him so. It was sloppy, it was rushed, and they tried to squeeze 10 pounds into a 5-pound bag. And there was no soul, there was no pacing. It was just, let's get us all in. Sloppy stuff. Ziggler takes a head. I'll tell you what, if one of my kids took a headlock the way he took the headlock, I'd have stopped him in a training camp. I'd have stopped him right there and said, look, can you get a, you know, put a vertical? I mean, when JR says vertical base, he had none. He was bent over. His feet were close together. There was no indication that he was going to work that headlock. It was, I'm going to grab it because you're going to shoot me off. And then I'm going to roll over here and you're going to roll over there. There was no flow to this thing, no crispness, no snap. And I'm a big Kofi fan. I could be a Ziggler fan too, but it wasn't a good match. It was an indie match. It was a fair indie match. It wasn't even a great indie match.
Well, I was surprised to hear them say that, because you said everything when you said no soul, and it was like that was the match that this is the one we did on SmackDown for, and that's exactly right. Now I talked with Brian about this on Observer Live a few weeks ago too, where it's just, I think sometimes it's like Chris Rock had a skit on his old HBO show, Low Expectations Scrabble, where the words only spelled O and Ho. And it's like, you know, just because it doesn't offend you, or just because you've become so desensitized to something, it doesn't mean it was good. It's still what it is. And that's, again, no soul, and
well,
I'm not blaming those two.
But that's, it's just, it's too bad that it's like that.
I fought this battle. I have people say, you know, Kofi couldn't be a champion in my promotion. I like Kofi. As a kid, the kid worked, the first time I ever met him, been in the business 6 months. He came from Boston with a bunch of other kids to a camp that Dr. Tom and Steamboat and Terry Taylor and I did one weekend down in the Carolinas. We were all impressed with just a short period of time he'd been working and how good he was. But it was rushed. It was, when I say no soul, they wave their arms and they make big noises and shake their legs and grab their crotches and do all the crap that somebody behind the scenes thinks that makes a character. But there was no soul to the match. There was no Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat. There was no Flair in Steamboat. There was no Jack Briscoe, Dory Funk Jr. It was just, let's get our shit in and go home. And that's not going to draw you 50 cents. And that's basically the problem with WWE across the board right now. Christian is one of the most valuable players because he could take either one of those kids and slow them down and turn it into a decent match. The problem there, even though Kofi's got more, far more experience than Ziggler, is that they get caught up in getting their stuff in, and you know, there's no ultimate story there. It was just, you know, let's get it all in, and nobody hardly sold anything, you know, and again, it's so you shake your legs and pump your fist and. But in the bottom line, once the bell rings, all that is just crap. It just doesn't. It's the icing. It's not the cake.
I think Rich and I talked about this last week, but I'm not real sure. But after Monday, it can be brought up again. Alex Riley, I liked from the moment he was on NXT, and they did the little personality skit with him, where he was just, you know, being the cocky jerk. And obviously I'm partial because I was a fan of his father on radio and had a chance to grow up with him on watching him on TV and everything. But he's tall, he's good looking, he can talk. It drives me nuts because obviously forget about the continuity problems with the storyline when it comes to him, but he's one of those guys that I wish, you know, Heartland was still going. I wish OVW was still going in the way that it was going, you know, a few years ago, where I don't want to see Alex Riley, even as good as he is in some areas now, I don't want to see Alex Riley for like a year or two because it's just, he seems to have the whole package, but obviously he can't wrestle because, you know, he hasn't been doing it that long. And it's too bad that he's not going to have a year or two, I mean, much less like three or four, but, you know, realistically a year or two just to go somewhere because he's already almost right there in a lot of ways, and it's just too bad he's not going to be able to develop the way that he should, and I worry about it. And just because it's happened with so many guys, you know, for different reasons. Drew McIntyre was one reason. I mean, what they did with, you know, the whole Spirit Squad. The fact that Dolph Ziggler is still on that roster after being Chavo Guerrero's caddy and the Spirit Squad and everything else that has happened with him, I mean, I have concern over what happens with Alex Riley, and it's like, can they possibly drop this? What's your opinions on him right now? And obviously it's not his fault he won't get a chance to develop wrestling-wise, but what do you do? What advice would you have for him to not get caught up in the traps or fall into the laziness or just don't get too defeated by what might happen to him? I mean, what do you say to a guy like that who's,
I'm overstating him,
but he seems almost there in a lot of ways.
You know what strikes me about Riley that's good? He doesn't wear cutoff jeans. He doesn't have a saying. He doesn't have a hand signal. He acts like a human being.
Yeah.
And that makes him stand out from the crowd. And now, if they decide they have to change all that, I mean, the point is, here's a guy who was, you know, say what he was, whatever you want to call him, to Miz, and Miz abused that. All of us have worked for somebody that's been, a boss that you didn't like, you know, the whole nine, you know, take this job and shove it, the whole thing. Okay, so now, does this, you know, if they let that just build off of the personalities of this thing and give it some soul, will it be a great wrestling match? Probably not. But see, you know, I've seen guys who weren't great workers draw, but you got to cover their butts, you know. the fact that that Cole and Lawler are hugging and kissing now doesn't do a thing for me.
No.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's just bad.
He's
on with
the
pamphlet
to me.
Yeah, I know you watch Dancing. I like watching. I'll tell you what I like about watching The Voice, American Idol, and then America's Got Talent star. There was a kid on America's Got Talent last night who was uncomfortable. He played electric piano. Apparently has never performed in front of a crowd, maybe once or twice in his life. And he had this soulful voice that just blew everybody away because he felt it. And that's what's lacking. You know, if something's I was thinking last night watching that, if something's lacking on Tough Enough, I don't see that. You know, I see guys who look like they're pretty fair mechanics. You know, they're pretty fair athletes. Do I expect any of them to be a star on Raw? I hear now that one of them might wrestle. Is he going to blow anybody away? Absolutely. I don't care which one of those three guys win or two guys win. No, they're not going to blow anybody away because they're not ready to blow anybody away. But, you know, that's what I like about these singers, that these kids have developed somewhere, you know, in little bars or clubs or maybe just in their backyard from like this kid last night. They said, how often do you perform? He said, almost every night. You know, in at home. No, we mean in front of a crowd. He said, almost never. And he was, I mean, he had to take a couple of deep breaths before he could even start in front of the judges. And he just blew, I mean, he blew the judges away. He blew me away. I mean, this kid was soulful as hell. I loved it. And that's what draws you in. It's not Ziggler and Kofi going through the motions and waving their arms. And that's what I think Alex Riley brings to the table, is a human element. Not a goofy costume or a goofy gimmick, you know. Now, if they feel they've got to go that route, I think they'll take something away from it. Mike, I think that's as simple as that sounds. It's that complex because they're trying. They think you got to cover everything with, you know, fluff and craziness and goofiness to make it work. And if they stop to think what's drawn them all the money in their last three WrestleManias, they'll realize that none of that crap matters.
Now, that's what
it's your turn to get on your soapbox.
and that's like the thing with, you know, and exactly. And Jeremiah, and, you know, speaking of Tough Enough, you look at Jeremiah, and it's, I hope he continues and wants to actually be a professional wrestler. I don't know exactly. I mean, obviously, he's got a low-level MMA career. But after watching him in 2 weeks ago, because we didn't have a chance to talk about it, with him on that tour bus, and just, I mean, from his two front teeth that went shooting out of his face, you know, on the first episode, it showed more charisma in my eyes than everybody else on there is combined. And that includes, you know, Luke's smarmy, you know, routine that he's got going on, if that's just him, you know. But I think Austin, you know, showed it this past week when he took the belt from him. It's guys like that who, you know, realistically, you know, even if he would have won the show, he's one of those guys, when you look at their history and their reputation, that they would seem to not have any time for whatsoever. But I really hope, now that he's gone off of this show, I'm not sure exactly what he's doing right now, but I hope they actually give him somewhat of an opportunity, because you look at a guy like him, and it reminds me of the Briscoes, who, I mean, from a creative aspect, I'm incredibly happy that they're with Ring of Honor, you know. But, you know, for their, you know, financial stake, I wish they would get picked up by WWE. You know,
Luke, I don't like is he's working. Every time he goes on camera, he's working.
Yeah,
and it's obvious he's working. He's obvious to a worker anyway. It may not beat everybody else. Now, the big kid who's got the child and the child on the way, I like about him? He's it's real. You know, he's a gentleman. He's well, you know what they call him, the quiet assassin or whatever the hell he called himself from the
Silent Rage.
Silent assassin. Yeah, whatever. Silent Rage. Yeah, because Steve was pissing him off, but he wanted to respect Steve, and you could see it, right? And he was probably going to tear up if they'd have kept at it. But that's real, and that's, you know, again, that's Funk Jr. and Briscoe. That's and I mean Jack. I don't mean the two in Ring of Honor. You know, that's Flair and Steamboat. That's the element that's missing, you know, so much in our business, is it's so phony, and I don't mean the work, I mean the crap, you know, you're pretending to be this or that, and that doesn't come across and sell the fans. When Wahoo McDaniels got on a microphone, he said he would kick somebody's ass, you could go to the bank with that. I mean, it was as big a work as anything, but, you know, the fans that bought it, and that's what you know, Kofi's an entertainer. He's a good kid. I like Kofi as a person. He's humble and he's just really a nice kid. But he's an entertainer. He's not going to draw you. I mean, you know, Lance Storm and I had this conversation too. You can be a good worker. That don't mean you should be world champion. There's a lot of good workers that have no business being a world champion.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
but I disagree with you.
Everybody shouldn't be, and that's
title.
The problem with WWE too. My God, is there anybody on that show that hasn't worn a belt at least twice?
True, but I disagree with you on obviously he'd be, you know, it would be a TV title or something in a different time, but you know what, I don't exactly blame them for, because in the way Kofi and Dolph and a lot of these guys, they should be in the Intercontinental and U.S. title picture. The problem is they don't care about the belts anyway, and they don't, again, they let these guys go through the motions. I mean, Triple H has said it a million times. I mean, frankly, when they go out there, they should not be as lazy as they are with stuff as far as, you know, the headlock. I hate that. Like, just the headlock, and you know you're going to get put. I mean, when they telegraph everything because they don't care, that actually is on them for them to do. I mean, they should have professional pride and personal pride in what they do. But with that said, when they let him get away with it, and it's like, again, with Triple H being so great at what he does, I mean, people don't think he should be a Hall of Famer. That's so idiotic. I mean, Jesus. You got to give the guy his due and the Undertaker and guys like that. But the fact that he's supposed to be building this and helping to build it, and he's got, I mean, he's great in so many ways. Either it's the writers or whatever the issues are, that's the stuff that needs to be fixed, because Dolph Ziggler should be teaching Kofi Kingston how to wrestle right now, the same way Bryan Danielson should be teaching Sin Cara how to wrestle and not bringing up a Verno.
Cena should be learning how to work. But
that's
not going to happen anytime soon.
When you said
these guys should be contenders.
Like,
see, there's the difference between a script writer and a booker. A smart booker knows a guy can be a contender, but you never put your belt on him. You have him sniffing at that title, but he never quite gets it. Because then sometimes you've taken that illusion away, and he can't carry that belt.
Ronnie Garvin.
As the world, yes. Now he came into South. He was our champion in Southeastern. That's why he was so effective for Poffo. But he was strong for us. But it was the way he was built from the get-go. You got to realize back during the regional times, during the territory times, most of the people in Knoxville had ever seen him, right? In any way, shape, or form. I shouldn't say that because the Garvins were Tennessee for a while. But I mean, when he was brought in there, he was fresh. He was on, and he was made to be, you know, a badass from the get-go. The same with the Stomper, right? But now you got two different people there too. But I mean, the point is, all these kids, they are kids with WWE or TNA for that matter. Just because they can take great bumps, or because they're good-looking kids, or because they can wave their arms and legs better than you and me, doesn't mean you should put a belt around their waist. It means they can be a contender. And that's also, if you've got a heel champion, that sweet-looking contender getting his ass handed to him, even if it's in a devious, sneaky way, puts more heat on your champion and makes the people want to see that kid beat him more. But once he does, that's your climax, baby. Sex is over.
Yeah. And, I know we're pressing up against the hour break here, but – you know, Ronnie Garvin for me, I mean, Jesus, I love Ronnie Garvin. And don't get me wrong, a lot of people dismiss him as, gee, I can't believe he's entitled to him. But it's like, you know, I loved him against Jake Roberts. I loved him against Ted DiBiase. I mean, I loved him through Tully Blanchard. That whole thing with Crockett and watching him on TBS, I loved Ronnie Garvin. With that said, and I was, man, I can't wait, you know, the matches with Flair, and I loved Flair. And it was like, this is going to be great. And then he won, and it was like, oh. And that's the part where it's like, I know Ric Flair is what I consider a world champion. And they tried to do that whole, you know, working man's thing, and it didn't, it just, it's too bad it failed because I like Ronnie Garvin so much, and you know, but so I didn't want to sound like I was insulting him at all because I love him.
Oh, no, no, you weren't. But, you know, that's just, like, that's like when with Morton and Gibson, great tag, I mean, a great babyface tag team. Ricky knew, I mean, Ricky was such a, knew how to sell and knew just how long to sell. And the single matches with Flair were great matches, but thank God they never, you know, there was never a script writer who decided that Ricky should beat Flair for the world title because it wouldn't have done a thing for the belt and it damn sure wouldn't have done anything for Flair or Morton because Morton was that kid, the underdog who needed to stay an underdog in that situation. Now that means he'd go right back to the Rock and Roll Express and work with Midnight Express and win, you know, but see, and that's where I've always seen Kofi. Kofi is Bob Holly's cute partner who sells his ass off for the grizzled veteran to get the hot tag. But he's not your U.S. champion 10 times over because he's been in the business 15 minutes.
You brought Christian before, too. I do want to say this, too. I hope before Christian goes dirty, because and I guess there's talk, I think Dave said that Meltzer said that they may be rethinking this, but I'll say this, before he goes dirty, if he goes dirty, I'm hoping, and again, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't have any hope or faith in anything that anyone does anymore in wrestling or in sports entertainment, but if they're serious about Ted DiBiase, and they got him back with Cody, and they basically, you know, he put the bag on his head and took it off, is not saying he's born again type of thing, but if they're serious about refocusing what they had, because they did have something, at least I believe, in Ted DiBiase Jr., I hope I get Christian Ted DiBiase, because that will be the best thing for Ted DiBiase, and it will be a good reason to send Christian into madness before they end up turning him dirty. I hope if that's the direction they go, I hope this thing, and I hope this works for Ted DiBiase, because, you know, I know he's, I don't want to say falling in that Shelton Benjamin category because it was actually, it's far, far worse for Ted DiBiase, but I hope they can give him his break, and I hope they don't screw this up again because it's their fault, not his, I believe.
Well, you know, I think with Ron Killings, is he going to get over as strong as they want him? I don't think so. I mean, for several reasons, and it's nothing to do with Ron's talent or lack there, you know, that he's got a lot or he doesn't have any. I mean, it's got nothing to do with his talent. First of all, they've misused him over the long haul. To have built him to this point with Cena, he should have beaten a couple significant baby faces. I mean, and I don't mean just quickly on television in 3 minutes or something, but I mean, you know, to work a program with him, to build to this point. And then I don't mean he needs to throw a drink on a plan at ringside. He needs to kick Cena's ass, period, end of story. And I don't know if they'll allow that, you know.
Well, God, less will it matter if this guy does it? He just got beat up by two of them and Superman survived.
Well, you know what? I don't know. I've never seen Superman draw any money in our business.
I remember there was a Batman in Pittsburgh. Was there an actual Superman? Somebody had to.
That was Tony Marino. That was Batman. Tony Maria was Batman, wasn't he? Yeah. Marino was Batman, not Superman. But no, I mean, you know, if the babyface doesn't have the vulnerability, you know, if the heel can't sneak over him, then, I mean, that's the story. You know, that's the story on Law and Order. That's the story on Justified. That's the story on Criminal Minds. It's, you know, the baby faces have to find a way around the devious, you know, conniving, sneaky, vicious bad guys. That's life. And they, all of a sudden, sports entertainment is going to change that. Well, you know what? I got news for them. They're going to do all right, but they're never going to set the world on fire trying to change it because it's older than the three of us combined, for Christ's sake. You know? It's reality. It's life.
Now, there's not much older than the three of us combined.
Well, I don't know. I'm probably older than the both of you combined, but that's neither here nor there either.
Well, yeah.
But, I mean,
we don't
want
to make you feel bad, but, yeah.
It's all right. You can't. I feel bad all the time. I watch wrestling on television.
All right, on that note, let's take a 60-second break to catch our breath. We'll come back and probably talk a little old school. Mike, I know you want to delve into some stuff, so come up with a topic. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
You're listening to the GWH Radio Network, brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Your show will return momentarily. Did you know that there's more to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com than just Georgia Wrestling History? It's true. Not only can you find documented cards, results, and more on pro wrestling in Georgia dating back to the 19th century, but you can also find out where live and local wrestling may be near you today, and not just in Georgia. We also cover the southeastern regional scene in Alabama, Florida, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. You want more? Well, we also cover the major worldwide wrestling and MMA promotions as well, including WWE, UFC, TNA, Strikeforce, Ring of Honor, and more. And so do our radio shows. You can find all of this and maybe a bit more by logging on to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we are capturing the legends of yesterday and covering the stars of today. GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
All right, back on Ringside Wrap. I just want to let everybody know, if you want to get in here and give us a call, we're going guest-free this week, and it's allowed us a little extra time to hit the topics, brush over them, and get to some good old-fashioned wrestling the way we used to like it, and hit some topics. Maybe Les can provide us some insight. If anybody wants to get in here and join in the conversation, feel free. The number is 347-324-5735. Again, that's 347-324-5735. Hit us up. You can talk about anything we've already talked about or raise a new topic. I want to run down real quick, too, also, just while I'm thinking about it, before we do close the show tonight, don't want to forget it, Dragon Gate USA, big weekend, two IPPVs, one, I believe, let's see, Friday and one Sunday, and, of course, Saturday show they'll be taping, but you can get those two internet pay-per-views by going to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and logging on there and pick them up. Mike, what you got?
You know, it's just going to sound like I'm messing with Les tonight, but I've actually started reading Gary Hart's book, which I don't know if either one of you guys has ever seen.
No.
I actually was lucky enough to edit the final, or at least be one of the guys editing the final draft, and never actually got the book. Is it out of print now?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it is hard to find. Somebody gave me a copy of it. It's the only reason why, because every time I've tried to find it, I can't get it, and it's driving me nuts, because I want to get, you know, Dutch Mantell's book. There's a lot of books. I've been very deficient, but now that I've got this this Nook, I've been trying to just get a whole bunch more, and the Road Warrior Animals book and everything, but I had to see Hart's right away, because I've always been really enthralled with him on his stories, because he's done such a good job, and he's been so many places starting out in the 50s, and he's able to remember a lot of things, and he's taken such a different path in a lot of ways than a lot of guys have. So I was always enthralled with him. I always loved his character, you know, the throughout watching World Class in the 80s and into, you know, when I really sinks in with the Great Muta stuff and Crockett in 89, especially in Terry Funk. I mean, it was incredibly influential on me. So, and how he carried himself always was different, you know, than a lot of other managers out there. It's just he came across as real to me. And funny a lot how real he was in the book, but I don't mean to take the most negative thing first, but I want to actually ask Les about, obviously when people talk, I've always heard Tennessee finishes and stuff like that, and it's always, I always think, okay, it's Memphis that they're talking about and stuff like that. When it comes to cracks about Tennessee or looking down upon anyone that came from Tennessee, did you, because he has got a crack in there, and obviously some of this also for people listening stems from Jerry Jarrett going into Atlanta and some issues that Gary Hart had there, and just there was some backstory behind it of why he got these opinions of everybody, but were you ever painted with a quote-unquote Tennessee brush? Or what did you think when you did hear that popped up? Did you hear that at all, or is that something that comes up now?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I probably never would have ended up going to Tennessee if it hadn't have been for Ken Lucas and Dennis Hall.
who were two guys who were close personal friends. And, of course, Dennis is my tag team partner. I work with Luke a lot. And they were in there, and I was finishing up. And, you know, I'd been in Charlotte a year and a half, had worked the six mans with Becker and Weaver. It's all the heel teams with managers, which there were about almost, I think, a half dozen at the time. But anyway, you know, I knew it was time for me to, you know, to get out for a while. And I was just looking around, and they said, really, you know, it's not as bad as you've heard. And otherwise, I probably never would have ended up there. And I never looked at talent because they were there as not being good talent. Wow. You know, but I don't think I was ever.
What were you told going in? Huh? They were cheap paying it. Well, what were you told going into it? Like, it's not as bad as you hear as far as, were they, like, cheap paying hillbillies? I mean, what did you hear going in? What were the negatives
well,
going
it's just,
in there?
Well, it wasn't so much the guys. I never, you know, I don't know that I ever thought, well, there's no good workers there, or they're all goofs or shooters or anything else. It was that you know, Nick was Nick, and a lot of guys didn't want to work for him, and the you know, long trips and short money, and, you know, when I know George Grant, God rest his soul, was refereeing in Charlotte when I got ready to go, and he made me a bet. He said, "You're never gonna get $100 payoff." And I said, "Well, George, I won't be there long if I don't." And he said, "Well, you call me the first one you get." And the crazy thing was, the first night I worked in Memphis, I made $125. I'll never forget because I called George and I said, "George, you owe me $5. Here's the address where you can send it to me," right? But I won't say that Nick never tried to take advantage of me. Give you a quick example. Damn it, I'm trying to think of the name of the town now in Virginia. Norton, Virginia was Nick's town, God knows why, but it was 400 miles from Nashville, right? 400 miles from Nashville, and I'd been there for a while, and I've got my booking sheet, and it says Norton, Virginia, and I thought, there ain't no damn way, you know, because I knew it, you know, we didn't have TV in there, and it didn't draw, and I'd heard the stories, and I mean, it was the first time I'd ever balked at, you know, at something like that, and I went in the office, I said, Nick, I'm not going to Norton, Virginia, this is crazy. Oh, boy, hey, you're over in Norton, Virginia. I said, what do you mean? I've never been to Norton. Hey, they get that Roanoke TV, and you were hot, you know, for the Crockett's for, you know, for almost 2 years up there, and you're, you know, man, you're going in there, and they're going to hear see your name on them posters, and you're going to draw money. I said, really? Oh, yeah. I said, well, if I'm going to draw that well, then you can fly me up there. Well, I can't do that, boy. I said, okay, well, then I can't go. I'm not driving 800 miles for $25. I'm just no. I mean, you know, you had to bow your back every once in a while. I never really had a lot of problems with Nick. I mean, you know, a couple situations like that. But overall, I did all right in there. When I came back out of the Maritimes and went in there before I went to Tampa in 71, or came back actually in the fall, October of 70, came home here to Cincinnati for a week or so and then went back into Nashville. It just wasn't the same, and I wasn't being used all that well, and now I know Jarrett thought that Hall and Lucas and I all three left because he was given, you know, some control, and honestly, that if I stayed around, that might have been the reason, and when I say that, I don't mean that in a slanderous way, but honestly, the reason I went is because Garibaldi was one of the bookers in Tampa. I'd been to Tampa before, and I had an opportunity to go in, you know. So that was, you know, and it just wasn't, business wasn't that good in terms of, for me, in Nashville, you know, that second time around. So I'd just gone back in there because that's where I'd been when I went to Canada. I went up to Eastern Canada. So but I never, it was more about the payoffs and the trips. I mean, you could stay out on the highway for, I'll tell you, Hall and I, we did three TVs one Saturday in three different towns. We worked Knoxville on Friday night. Yeah. We worked Knoxville on Friday night. We did Knoxville TV Saturday morning for Kazana.
went to pull our, you know, toweled off. I mean, you know, kind of washed off. Didn't have time for a shower. Got in the car, headed to Chattanooga. Stopped, got something to eat. And I realized this is back, too, when it wasn't all I-85s and 65s and, you know, I mean, there was a lot of secondary roads. This is back in the 60s, late 60s. So all these superhighways weren't completed at the time. And grabbed some bite to eat, got down, did Harry Thornton's Chattanooga TV, did the same thing there, went to Birmingham. Birmingham was live on Saturday night, for Christ's sake, 10 to 11. And worked Birmingham TV and then drove back to Nashville and got home, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning or some damn thing. I don't even remember. But that was, you know, now if I'd have been doing that every week, I wouldn't have been there very long. But that was, there were conflicts. There were conflicts.
We got a caller on the line, Les. Let's see what they got to add here. Caller
okay.
from the Metro D.C. area. You're on the line.
Hello. I'm kind of off topic. Hello, can I hear you?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just wondering. I'm kind of off topic with what y'all was talking about, but I was wondering, have y'all ever watched N.W.A. Hollywood? And what's y'all opinion of that? And I wanted to ask Les, what's his opinion of Davey Richards?
Davey Richards, I like Davey Richards. I think he's a hell of an athlete, hell of a good little wrestler. I had the opportunity to work with Davey when he was living in Charlotte. I was down there and did a camp for High Spots, and actually it's the first time I met Davey. He had just won the Super 8, and, you know, we got a chance to work together a couple days there, and we've had a good relationship. I'd settle him down a little bit, I think. He's got too much ROH style, and that's not always a good thing. But I like him. He's a hell of a little athlete. He's serious. He's, you know, when I first got a look at him, he reminded me a little bit of a young Benoit to a certain degree. I've never had the chance to see the Hollywood NWA, but I hear they do a pretty good show.
Yeah, I know Dave Lagana works on it now. I haven't seen it in a while, but it's him, Adam Pearce. I forget who else is involved in all that, but I've heard it's pretty good. I've never seen the early ones, and it was okay. I just, you know, with all the other stuff I have to watch, I don't get a chance to see it. And I tell you, Davey Richards is, and talk about Lagana too. He did a great job last year with a lot of different things, but getting his personality and getting his drive across when he was going after Tyler Black in the ROH title, I mean, it really, I thought, did wonders to actually help his overall package, and I'm thrilled that he's continuing to wrestle and didn't end up retiring or anything like that, because he is fantastic.
And, yeah, I'm kind of like Mike on the NWA Hollywood thing. I caught a couple of the first episodes, really enjoyed it, just with time constraints. It's just a little difficult to fit it in every week. Yeah, you got any other questions for us?
Oh, okay, one more.
All right.
How did the USWA started working with WWE? How did that come about? Like when Jerry Lawler started coming to work for Vince, how did that happen? How and why?
Wow.
Mike, that might be
well, part of that was when Vince was – when that whole drug trial was going on, Jerry Jarrett was actually brought in to kind of oversee it was the WWF at the time. It wasn't WWE yet, but Jerry Jarrett was brought in. Well, you know, USWA was kind of the last survivor of the territories. They continued to, I don't know about flourish because I wasn't there, but continued to run and draw pretty decent, even though a lot of the territories had died, you know, when WWF was trying to take over the country. And then, you know, Jerry's a good businessman. I mean, he's had working relationships with the Von Erichs when Texas was hot. He had a working relationship with Ganya and AWA and always had a good relationship with most of the NWA territories. So he's always been smart enough, you know, to not just go out and indiscriminately get in wars with people. And I think, and he's got a good head, a good businessman. So I would think, you know, probably that's part of it and I think Vince probably watched and thinking, how are these guys surviving when everybody else is closing their doors? And so probably out of a bit of respect, you know, that there was some sort of business relationship formed.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. Is one, obviously, yeah, Jerry Jarrett, if Vince would have went to jail, it's pretty clear that Jerry Jarrett would have been the one that ran WWF after that whole steroid trial went down. But also, he wanted Jerry Lawler, and there's lots of reasons on it. I mean, Lawler sued when Harley Race was made the king and beat Vince in court. I mean, he would grandstand challenge Vince in a lot of ways, and he just was always, he was a thorn in his side, but when he wanted him to be an announcer and he wanted him to be up there with Bret Hart and all that stuff, I think that's what kind of started that relationship. And basically, Memphis became a developmental that went on for quite some time after that. I know it was into the Attitude Era that they were still doing things there, because I know Kurt Angle and Rock was there as Flex Cabana, and that went on for, you know, so they were there for a while after that too. But I think, yeah, it's just general respect, the fact that these guys, you know, they had other business interests, and the fact that they wanted Lawler and they needed developmental. It all just seemed to work together. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the Mr. McMahon character that ended up coming, you know, really to the forefront in the late 90s, I guess from 97 on, was something that had seeds planted in Memphis with a USWA WWF feud that most people don't remember, because it was at the down, you know, probably the most down point of WWE's creative history in the last 30 years, or arguably, I guess you could say that. I don't want to insult anybody, but they were still obviously kind of stuck in an older mode, and you know, the seeds for that character were actually planted in him hating Memphis and hating the rednecks down there.
And those cheap paying hillbillies, right?
Well, that's what the angle was on TV, but I don't mean to insult everybody there, but, you know, I think Gary Hart's line in there was the only roses in that briar patch of hillbillies was Jerry Lawler, and I can't remember who the other one was. Maybe I think it was Ron Fuller, actually.
All right. Does that get all?
Gary was never short on speaking his mind.
he was a city boy. He's a Chicago guy. You know, some places aren't made for everybody.
You know, it's funny you brought his book up and that, because somebody asked me the other day about Gary. I forget what it was about now. First time I ever met Gary, I mean, he was just a scrawny, straight up and down, had his hair bleached blonde, and he had come with somebody down from Chicago to work the television in Indianapolis. And they put him and I against Art Nelson and Stan Hollick. It was the Nelsons. Nielsons, actually. They call them Nelsons. It was Art and Stan Nielsen. Stan Hollick and Art Nelson. And I'd worked with those guys, you know, several times on TV and in some house shows. So Art says to me, you know, and none of us knew Gary from anybody. I don't know how long Gary had been around, but obviously not too long, as the story will tell. And so anyway, Art says, you start the match. I said, okay. So I started, and we did a little thing, and I said, okay, tag the guy in. And so I tagged Gary in, and Gary was so bad, and I don't know if it was just nervousness or what, but he was green as grass at the time anyway, but he was so bad, Art grabbed him and brought him to the corner and had Gary's arm by the wrist and forced Gary to tag me. And when I came in, Art hooked me and he said, if you let him back in, I'm going to kick your ass. I said, I got it covered, man. Or don't let him in until the finish, because they were supposed to beat him. But that was my first introduction to Gary, and of course he came a long, long way. He had a tremendously fertile mind. He was a hell of a manager, and you know, a great talent he really was.
You know, God, what do you think about the? And he obviously, you know, was a booker, but you know, he gets lumped in with that quote unquote outlaw class and the quote unquote Japan guys. What were your opinions as being an NWA guy and being a guy who, you know, you lived in your territory, you worked with your territory, you know, what did you think of the Brodies and that type of guy, like Mark Lewin and the guys who were in that clique and a little unpredictable, the Iakea types and those types of guys who could go make money anywhere. They were a little bit difficult to deal with. They would do some odd things sometimes. What were your opinion of them, or what was the prevailing sentiment in Knoxville and where
you were,
as far as those guys?
The funny thing is, I always got along with those guys. I mean, Frank, I, you know, when we were working for Savoldi, you know, up in New England. Somebody's, in fact, I've got an old tape or some old pictures. I shouldn't say a tape, but old pictures. It was Brody and Gary and Sullivan and Nancy. And anyway, I've always, you know, like Thunderbolt was difficult for people. I always got along with T-Bolt. Always got along with Claude. Always got along with Brody. I never had a problem. I think, I guess because I always kind of walked a little left to center myself, I just kind of understood those guys, I think. New Jack, everyone talked, New Jack and I have a hell of a relationship. We always, I mean, from the get-go, when they came into Knoxville, he and I have always gotten along well, and I know we have respect for one another. And, it's just, I think that's, the crazy thing is, in our business, if you don't make adjustments, then you drive yourself nuts. You know, I think that's one of the keys, because there's so many people from so many walks of life. I never saw the bad side of Brody. Curtis, I never knew. I couldn't give you an answer about Curtis, so I don't have a clue. Lars Anderson was supposed to be difficult to deal with, and I've seen that with some other people. I never had any. We had a good, decent relationship, I thought, you know.
Well, I got one for you, actually, because he doesn't talk highly about him in the book, and it's Joe Blanchard. Now, was he doing the announcing for Barnett in Indianapolis when you were there?
Yes, yes. And
he,
I worked with Joe.
He hates Joe.
Well, you know what? I would say that probably stems from the Texas relationship.
Because he always said, he says very simply, you know, the only success he ever had was Barnett, and I guess Gary's got a thorn in his side over people that overpraise Bosch and Blanchard and a lot of other people in Texas, where they're like, hey, look, you couldn't have done anything without the Dallas booking office, and we were the reason that you got the guys that you did. And I guess he had said that Fritz sent Joe, and I can't remember off the top of my name, I can't remember who was there at the time, but the two people that were there, he said, he's buying in. They're like, well, no, he's not. He's like, yes, he is. And he never had any respect for him. And I guess because he never did anything. He was happy to worry a little bit about San Antonio, and he had his head up his butt as far as a big picture sort of thing, which ended up kind of meeting itself out down the line. It was, you know, losing the USATV and stuff like that. But it was just, you know, so the only success he had was as an announcer, and that was it.
Joe was now Barnett used Joe as a good baby face. I wouldn't say he was on top, as I recall, but I mean, this is back when I was buying tickets too. But Joe was doing more announcing, and when I came on board in 62 with Barnett, and quite frankly, he was very helpful to me on several occasions, you know, with suggestions and stuff, and was always cordial. Never, you know, was like, I'm the veteran and you're the punk kid, you know, and get used to it. It was, I never felt that. In fact, I never felt that, I don't think, with I can't think of anybody, the top guys there. You know, I mentioned working with Poffo, my first TV, but I worked with Eddie Fairhot, the Sheik, and Fritz. I never had a problem with anybody that I'm aware of, but Joe was helpful with me. First time I ever met Tully, he was playing peewee football. And Tully and I have talked about this, but showed up at TV. You know, I guess he'd had an early game, and then he was in uniform, and Joe brought him to TV because he didn't have time to take him home. And that's the first time I ever saw Tully Blanchard in his little football uniform. He was probably about 12 years old or 14 or 13 or something. I don't know exactly, but I never had a problem with Joe, but I would guess part of that is due to that whole Texas thing, because, you know, that was so fragmented. And yeah, Dallas was, I guess they were the key. And honestly, from the best I can tell you, at one point I talked to Gary about coming in down there and doing television, and it just never materialized. But I think probably had Fritz let Gary have his head more and handled his the kids, you know, the Von Erich kids better and differently, that territory might have been different too.
Did you, I remember when, always hearing stories and reading that, you know, George Scott, when he left WWF and went down to World Class, with 86, whenever they did the split, and he was there, I always just thought he, like, just made bad decisions. I'd heard kind of little things before, and in reading the book, Jog My Memory on it, is there any, because it'll tie in with something else, is there any chance that George Scott sandbagged, just because, I mean, he's got a sterling reputation. A lot of people don't like him for different reasons as far as personality goes, but his booking is always, you know, the success he has always been regarded as pretty sterling. Do you think he sandbagged purposely on behalf of the NWA or anybody else, the world-class promotion when, like, Black Bart was made world champion and they did the Blackbirds thing and all that stuff?
I don't think so.
You think he just, it was by that point, you know what, he just misstepped too much. You know, he was just a little past him.
I don't know. Well, part of it is, here's the thing, you can be the booker, but if the guy who writes your check decides that they don't want you to do something, you're not going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, George Becker was the booker in Charlotte for a lot of years, but Mr. Crockett, you know, if he decided to pull the trigger, then something did or did not happen. When Danny Miller and I went in there as a number two babyface tag team out of Tampa in 71, I had a mustache. And, in fact, George, you know, who I'd worked the six-mans with Weaver and Becker, George says, Datch, you got a mustache. Gary Hart's got a mustache. I said, well, okay, whatever. And he said, well, somebody should shave it. And Mr. Crockett sitting behind his desk said, hey, baby, I like the way you look. That was the end of it. Nobody ever asked me to shave my mustache again. You know, that was, of course, see, George was, I mean, you got to realize, again, I'm no Bolshevik and no rebel in any way, shape, or form. Kirby and Hall and I had blonde hair, and we were baby faces. A lot of people told you back in the late 60s or mid 60s, you can't be a baby face and have blonde hair. We were. We did. Jerry Briscoe would tell you that, you know, long hair and tank tops and facial hair for baby faces. A lot of guys, and George, you got to realize where George Becker came from, right? I mean, he'd been in the business since, gosh, I don't know, early 40s. Baby faces were clean shaven and had short haircuts. We were talking about 1971 when it was a whole different time, you know. And George Scott did or didn't do had a lot to do with the politics. I think part of the problem in New York was that he wanted, you know, he saw more in Steamboat than he did in Hogan, which, I mean, if you're talking about mechanics, there is no comparison. I mean, we can't even talk about it.
Oh, my God, look what Steamboat did for him in the Carolinas with Ric Flair and with Paul Jones and everybody else.
Well, sure. Well, see, and then George was just doing what everybody else did. I got the offer to come up there and handle all the interviews. I flew to New York, took the limo up to Stanford. This was in 84, 85, I forget exactly. Exactly the time, but it was 84, 85. They flew me up there. George picked me up. We went to lunch, went to the office. Well, Vince was busy. I visited with Barnett, had an office up there at the time. And I went in and sat down with Vince. And, I could have had the job up there at the time, but they wanted me to move to Stanford. And my dad had passed away in 83, and my mom was still here. And I didn't want to, you know, and by living in Knoxville, I was, you know, just a few hours from her if I needed to get to her. And, of course, they said, well, you can move your mother to Stanford. But, hell, had I have done that, I'd never seen her at all, you know, because at the time, the schedule there, you were on the road for God knows how long, and I'd have put her in Stanford. She wouldn't have known a soul. At least here, she knew the neighbors and everything. But Anyway, that was part of the deal breaker. Plus, I was involved with something with Bob Polk on a television syndication thing in Knoxville, and I had a commitment to them. They made me a good offer in New York, or Stanford, or wherever the hell you want to call it, you know, WWF. And I'll never forget Vince saying to me, you know, he was wanting guys who were creative and maybe walked a little left of center. Pat Patterson, and, you know, I guess that was my reputation, too. And he said, George's going to be with me till he's got a beard all the way to the ground, you know, meaning George Scott. And when George, you know, I didn't go on board simply because of the reasons I just stated. And then when George was let go, I thought, my God, his beard grew fast. You know, but I think that was more a political thing with Hogan than it was that he didn't know what he was doing. Again, you know, a booker's like an artist. Whether it was Leo Garibaldi or Eddie Graham or Louis Tillette or George Becker or George Scott or whoever, they had a style, and that's how they, you know, made a territory pop, and they were going to use that style. You know, and I think George was looking more solid stuff, too, and where maybe Vince, and, you know, maybe part of it was, you know, Hogan obviously wasn't going to get down and swap holes and do sit-outs and switches. So, you know, there's no way he could compete with Steamboat or any of those, you know, Harley or anybody else in that respect. And no offense meant, but that just wasn't him, you know. If you're going to draw money with him, it's going to have to be his way. So I would think that's more why, and why he and Gary, I don't know. I have no idea why that, you know, I always had a good relationship with George Scott. Last time I saw George was a couple years ago in Charlotte, I don't remember. But
Gary's good with him. Gary's good with him. It's just that he was, when he came to World Class and was like making Black Bart the champion and everything that went on, it was like, either he's lost his step, and I guess there were rumors that, no, he could have been sent in. Not sent in, but, you know, as he had, you know, other interests at play and the success of, you know, Fritz branching out on his own.
Well, you know what? I have no idea, you know, whether
And the reason I threw it out there was because I was surprised to read, and I know, I love Mid-South. God, did I love Mid-South, and I love the UWF, and I remember, because it was the first time I had ever seen, and I remember, like, Watts kind of did it, but the one that will always stick out in my mind, the burial tape. I had never really seen a burial tape, and the Freebirds were coming in, and it was just them for, you know, the three-minute music video, just decimating the Von Erichs, and it was like, wow. And you know, the Missing Link and Tatum and all those guys that came in because Ken Mantell came in, that there was, I thought he just jumped and took his guys kind of with him, and obviously planning it out a little bit ahead of time, but Hart kind of indicates that Watts was doing this for a long, long time and was working with Mantell, again, sandbagging World Class and then bringing those guys over to kill Fritz. I was a little surprised that it came across to me, at least, that it was a far more orchestrated plan than I would have thought, or that I just had thought it was, and I was.
Well,
I just,
you know, I had people ask me if I thought Hogan was working for Vince down in TNA. I said, I it wouldn't shock me, but no, I doubt it. I doubt that Vince is that concerned with TNA, honestly. But you know, you mentioned UWF. I had the craziest, I meant to tell you guys, and it slipped my mind, and you just made me remember it again. I'm up at 4:30 in the morning. I'm in the gym by 6:30 to start working with my clients, and so I'm in bed early. In fact, when I get done with you guys, it won't be long before my head's going to hit the pillow. My phone rang just a little before midnight last night, and I saw my caller ID this morning that was up from New York State. A fan called. I don't even know where the hell he got my number. I never did identify himself. I was half groggy, but he wanted to call me and tell me he had been watching WWE on demand or WWE 24/7, and they were showing smoky matches that JR and I were the host, and I was interviewing, and it was Tracy against New Jack or so. I don't even remember all of it. He said, I didn't know I'd wake you up. He said, we must be on a different time thing. And I said, that's okay, you know, and I, He said, but I just want to let you know how good they were and how much I enjoyed it. I said, well, thank you.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You know, I sell wrestlers' phone numbers for $10.
Well, let me, if anybody would like to have Rich Tate's home number.
Oh, no.
Email me at...
Hey Les, one question I've always wanted to ask and never really have. I want to go back to your time here when you and Gordon Soley were both sitting behind the announcer's table for Georgia Championship Wrestling. We're talking, of course, 1973. For those not familiar with it, refresh my memory. Was it Jerry Jarrett that was booking at that time?
No, he came in when Barnett bought in. He came in early 74. And that's when I was getting ready to go back to Charlotte.
So,
yeah.
Okay,
no,
so,
Leo was the booker when
that's
I
right.
came
and,
in.
And that was his second stint as booker in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah.
When I first came in there
in 66 to wrestle, Leo was the booker.
Right. And I believe he left and around late 69, early 70, something like that. Here's my question, though, based off that. Typically, would Leo have been the guy running TV since he's booking the show? Is he considered the producer or I mean, how does that work?
Because he was, you know, what was built on TV was what had to get you interested to go to the house shows.
All right,
so ultimately
the question is, in 1973, when wrestling's still very territorial, how advanced or how much work went into, say, putting that TV together on the day of the show? I mean, you guys, I believe, were taping in the morning.
Yeah.
Was there like a production meeting to kind of take us through getting ready for the show?
Well, we'd go over it a lot in the office. You know, I was handling the public relations and publicity in the office as well and doing the weekly program. So I was there every day, and there were times, you know, Leo might call me into his office, say, here, you know, I want to run this by you, this or that, but then I'd pick Gordon up on Saturday morning at the airport, and then we'd go straight to the TV station, and then we would, you know, go over the format, and we'd make notes. I mean, you know, a lot of what we did behind that desk was totally improv. I mean, we'd make notes, and we'd get a run sheet or a format or whatever you want to call it, and say, you know, what do you want out of this match? Well, we need you, you know, to push so-and-so because he's working, you know, he's going to do this angle with such-and-such. And we just make notes in the margin of the format, you know, and we just we played off each other. That's the way I work with JR. That's the way I work with Cottle, Lance Russell, Charlie Platt. You know, the only time we never had headsets. So we never had anybody. We had a floor director that might cue us out. You know, if we were doing a break, you know, if we had to go to break, we'd have a floor director giving us hand cues, you know, that we, you know, 30 seconds left to cue out to commercial or you know, or whatever. But so much of it, we were just playing on the fly. It was just playing off of one another. It's in the book that Bob and Pam Allen did, but I'll tell you the story. If you haven't read the book or if you don't remember the story, that desk we had was high. I mean, they were really high. And the chairs that Gordon and I sat in were the kind that have the air shock in them, right, that, you know, you could raise them or lower them and so forth. One day we were just doing a show. I don't remember who was in ring. It doesn't really matter. But Gordon's chair sprung a leak, and he happened to be the one that was talking, and I just caught it out of my peripheral vision, and he started sinking into the sunset behind the desk, right? And his tone never changed or anything, right? And just before he dropped below the top edge of the desk, and he said, "And that's the way it looks from here, Les. What do you think?" And I just picked it up and went on with it. And
now, were you actually on the camera at the time, or was it just voice at that point? Was it just audio?
What?
Were you just doing audio and the cameras were somewhere on the ring?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were on the mat.
Or the camera's on you.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I just picked it up, and he got up out of the chair and pushed it out of the way and stood up until they could get him another chair. I mean, we never missed a lick, you know.
Was there any territory clip of
I can't remember if it was Bowden or Mid-South, of the Super Destroyer, Scott Irwin, storms off set during an interview, and the chair, the set, everything just falls apart on him. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that before.
No, I haven't.
But yeah, it was. We played a lot of it by ear. I mean, it was, you know, and Leo was, you know, that was the. We had so many creative people at the time, you know, involved. I mean, now Lester was part of the office. Fuller would come in occasionally, you know. And then when Watts came in, honestly, he and Leo butted heads a lot, but it was in a good way because we got better angles out of it and better stuff because we had two very creative people, that were the final analysis was that we had something good. But, you know, back then, both offices were drawn. I mean, they were selling out on Tuesday night. We were selling out on Friday night.
Right.
It was the craziest thing in the world. But, I mean, the territory was red hot. Now, I don't know how they were doing in their secondary towns, or at least I don't remember. But I do remember at the old auditorium downtown, you know, they'd sell it out on Tuesday. We'd sell it out on Friday.
All right. Mike, you got anything before we start plugging and wrapping up here? Anything else?
No, actually, no. Although it was nice to actually go through it and not have to talk much about WWE or TNA or really anything else this week. This is good for me this week.
Absolutely. Yeah,
well,
we
good,
need to do
Mike,
more
I'll
of this.
Send you a bill. Or
yeah,
you can send me Gary Hart's book when you finish it. I like to read it, too.
There ain't no problem. I need my wrestling therapy. That's
all right,
what this is.
So,
no sports entertainment, please.
Hey, Les, did you ever get the Pro Wrestling Revival thing worked out down here?
No, I have not heard about another date. One of the kids that works for Anarchy, I know, had mentioned there's new ownership up there, from what I understand, had sent me an email, said he was going to mention the new owner about me coming up there and doing something with them again, which I'd love to do.
Right.
But anyway, I am open for running camps or seminars or whatever, or haunting houses or whatever you have in mind. You can reach me at les@epwt.com. And then, of course, tomorrow I'm doing Wrestler's Eye Audio on PW Insider. Saturday, Wrestling Weekly with Doc and Will. And then back here on Wednesday night if we don't get hit with a sunstrokes, tornadoes, rainstorms, or whatever.
And of course, if you want Les's phone number, feel free to email me.
Right, exactly.
Be sure to call him up at midnight. It's always the best time. Mike, what you got going on?
I got another recording of the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare. I'm actually going to be recording that tomorrow, so it should be up on the Observer site. If not late tomorrow night Eastern time, then early in the morning on Friday. Still a lot to talk about. A bizarre story out of Japan with a guy by the name of Harai, who I believe has appeared in TNA. He's going under the name Super Hate right now. Thought it was an angle at first. It was not. He had suffered a stroke after a match, which was legitimate, but then they said he came from a beating from the Voodoo Murderers stables, the name of the group. And he was actually, apparently they sent Rene Dupree and they sent Joe Doering out of the locker room, and they ended up beating him, and it may have led to this stroke later on in the night. So a bizarre situation. We'll be talking about that and a whole lot of other things too, including maybe the match of the year anywhere in the world, Hiroshi Tanahashi and Yuji Nagata. Yuji Nagata is just more proof, like Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, a lot of guys, the old school, and having everything, no matter if your body holds up, you will be timeless and ageless, and had a great match with a guy who's arguably the number one, you know, performer in the world in a lot of people's eyes, Hiroshi Tanahashi. So that to talk about, plus a whole lot of other things as well. And then also with Brian Alvarez Sunday on Wrestling Observer Live, if we're not preempted by anything like we were the Coca-Cola 600, we will be on Sirius Channel 92. But if you can't hear us there, go to the sportsbyline.com website, WHSP.com. I know we're on a couple stations in San Francisco as well, and a bunch of other stations as well. Go to WrestlingObserver.com for all that information there.
Hey, here's a question for you guys. Do you ever get to plug this show on those shows?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have.
Absolutely.
Stop that.
Huh?
I have.
Oh,
stop
I'm...
that.
Yeah, yeah. When we had DeMond on a couple weeks ago, I plugged it on both the other shows.
There you go. All right. Just checking.
And we give out your phone number, too, so... It...
Hey, wait, no. Didn't you host Wrestling Observer Live with me for a little while one week?
What's that?
Didn't you host Wrestling Observer Live with me for a little while one week?
Yeah, nobody had a clue who the hell I was. That was weird.
And they still been like, okay, baby, still even sports
violence. Actually, it was so bad. You called me up, like, literally, like, I think about a half an hour before the show. And said something about Brian's deathly ill. Can you fill in? I'm like, okay, sure. Yeah, what are we going to talk about? And I do this little crash course, get ready for the show. We go live. We talk TNA for like an hour. An hour of TNA. I'm like ready to kill myself talking TNA for an hour. And that was so bad.
Callers.
And it was apparently so bad that Brian pulls himself out of his deathbed and makes it in for the second hour.
You know what? Brian used to do that to me, and of course now he's got Sempervisi, so he doesn't. But you know what? That's the modern thing too. I'd come home, and he's got all my phone numbers, but I'd come home and I'd turn on my computer and I'd see where 3 hours before he'd sent, "Hey, how would you like to do the show tonight? I need some help."
Yeah.
You know, of course, then by the time I see the email, it's too late to do the show anyway. But I've jumped on board a couple times like that too, Rich, so I don't feel bad.
Well, you know, I'm glad Mike reminded me of that, because I tell you what, Mike, we're going to talk an hour of TNA here one night.
Oh, God. I you
remind me
call.
When you're going to do that so I can do something else, okay?
You know, we get Ultimate Warrior, is he dead questions. We've gotten stuff like that. We don't take phone calls really anymore. If we do, it's usually from – we only put it up on the Observer site. So, you know, callers are a little bit better off than some of the questions that we can get on that show. Which, and I tell you, I swear to God, doing Wrestling Observer Live, I think every single person that was, you know, in that 1.1 – They listened to that show, because there would be so many TNA questions, it would just drive you crazy.
Ah, the hell with TNA. All right, that's going to do it here. Seriously, we want TNA to succeed. We really do. God, for the love of God, do something right. All right, that's going to do it here for us this week. I want to thank everybody, especially our caller, for getting in here and asking a few questions. Sorry he got cut off before we could get his name. Dick Steinborn joins the guys on Peach State Pandemonium tomorrow night here on the GWH Radio Network. Let me slow down and I can actually get that out. That's it for us this week. We'll see you here again next week. Later.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.